Hey, this is John Bollinger with Premier Guitar, and I'm with Peter Frampton at his rehearsal hall in Nashville, Tennessee. Peter, thanks for inviting us over.
Pleasure. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure. So, I've got to ask, this is probably the most iconic Les Paul in rock history.
Well, it's one of the good stories, yeah. It does have a good story.
Spill the details.
Well, I'll try and get to the point. There's a lot of points there. When I was playing with Humble Pie in 1971 in San Francisco, I had swapped my SG guitar that I was using at the time for a 335 Gibson. And with Humble Pie, we played so loud that every time I turned up for a solo, my solo consisted of which probably would be good now, but then it wasn't so good. So anyway, a friend of mine in the audience said, look, I couldn't help but see you've got problems there. We're playing at the Fillmore West for like three or four nights. And he said, I could bring you a Les Paul. I said, I'm not really big on Les Pauls. You know, I like SGs and stuff. And he said, anything's better than this. So he brought it the next, I played it that night and I don't think my feet touched the ground because it was so great. And it didn't feed back, which was great. And so when I came off stage that night, I just said, I gave it back to him, and Mark Mariana is his name, from the Bay Area. And I said, I don't think you'd ever sell this, would you? And he said, no. I said, well, that's fine. Thank you so much. He said, no, I'm going to give it to you. So, you know, like jaw dropping. Say that again. So, he gave me this guitar.
Wow.
In 1971.
Now, did it have the three pickups in it at that point?
It had just come back from Gibson. It was originally a 1954 Black Beauty. So it had the old P90s, the two different looking ones, right?
Yeah, the Alnico and the...
Yes.
Yeah.
And no middle pickup. And I don't believe it was black. And had it... I'm not sure if Mark actually routed it for a third pickup or whether he had Gibson do it, but he sent it back to them and said, look, after he'd done a lot of sanding and the body is thinner than... He was getting off the old paint job, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
The body is a little bit thinner because of his slightly heavy hand and the neck as well, which is why I love it so much. And so he had them route it for three humbuckers, and then... he wired it, I believe, the same way as I have it now, which is, if you forget about the middle pickup, the selector switch and goes straight to this volume, and this volume is a master volume for these two, the neck and the bridge position.
Sure.
Right. So that's a. There's the bridge. The neck, and then the two, and then if we turn that off, there's no switch for the middle position, but if you turn the bottom volume up,
right,
which gives you a big fat middle strat sound,
right?
You know, so if you bring it in with, let's see. That stratty sound, you know.
Totally.
And I dial that in whenever I feel like it, you know. And so that's the way it's, and then that's the master tone for these two, and that's the tone for the center one. So same thing. I used it from 1970, you gave it to me, not 1971, until 1980. And we went to, so it was on every record I played on my own, other people's projects. And then we went to South America for a tour in 1980. And we'd done Brazil and Argentina, and we were on our way to Panama to see Mr. Noriega at the time. Right. And who we almost saw. Unfortunately, we had a day off, so the equipment, we were flying commercially and having the gear underneath, you know. But we went separately because of a day off to Panama, and then the gear went on a cargo plane which crashed in Caracas, Venezuela on takeoff. So the only thing that was salvageable at all was, as usual, the tail of the plane. Well, we were told that everything was, I mean, it was 6-8 hours of just a huge inferno, you know. Wow. Unfortunately, people, the pilots and the loading people, all, we lost them. So that was very, very sad. And then I was told, I was having lunch in Panama by my tour manager, we've had a problem, you know. And I said, first thing I said was, oh gosh, is that mean my guitar? He said, yeah. So, and then he told me the tragedy of it all. And the guitar didn't seem to matter anymore at that point. And so I pretty much for the next 30 years mourned it and thought, oh, I bet it sounds like the best guitar in the world, you know. And every Les Paul I picked up sounded, nah, I don't think this is how my, you don't know though.
Right.
You've got no AB.
Sure.
You know, so anyway, about 4 years ago, I guess now, or more, 5 years ago, I'll have to work that out because I got it back when Framden Comes Alive 35 came out. So 5 years ago, just before, maybe six. So yeah, so, and I opened up my peterframden.com contact Peter here emails, and which I look at them all, and there's an email saying, check this out. And there's probably 12 or 15 forensically taken shots of this guitar with its white Seymour Duncans that it had on at the time. And, you know, with this here, and I knew it inside out. And as soon as I saw a picture with the pickups out, and I saw the way it had been routed, I've been inside there many times and yeah. checked it out and stuff. So I knew it was mine. It was pretty obvious, but I didn't agree with the chap who had it. But there's a sort of gray area there. Someone obviously stole it from the guard who was guarding the debris of the plane, thought that the guitars, which had obviously made it in the tail of the broken off tail. So they said that there were, this is 30 years later, they said there were like 4 or 5 guitars that made it and they were all sold, you know. And because when we went down there a week after the crash, they said, oh no, everything went up in flames. So it ended up being played by a musician in Caracas for like 15 years. And then people started saying, that looks an awful lot like, apparently. So then he went down to, he sold it to someone who lived in Curacao, and that's where it ended up. And the son of the person that ended up with it took it to a luthier to be worked on because it wouldn't play very well. And so that was the guy that actually took it apart, took pictures.
Wow, and tipped you off?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So it took another 2 years to convince everybody that was involved that we weren't going to have the FBI waiting at Miami airport for them. And eventually we met here in a hotel in Nashville, and I had, you know, video cameras going. I wanted to get the whole bit, you know.
Right.
And it walks in the door in this horrible vinyl guitar cover. I wouldn't even call it a case. You know, Peter, here it is, you know. Feel the weight, Peter. You know, this is the one. And because it is a light Les Paul. It's for a mahogany one. And so then I got it out. And you can, that video is online, and you can see it on FCA 35 video.
Oh, I've got to see it.
Yeah, it's 20 minutes long. So that's how we how I got it back. And then we went straight from the hotel room, we went straight to Gibson, and verified, you know, everything about it. And they took it apart and said that it was a 54, that you could see where it was originally conceived as a Black Beauty, you know, so.
Wow. You heard it here. Wow. Amazing story. We could stop now, but there's more stuff to show.
Yeah.
So that's incredible. So did your red Strat, the Show Me the Way, was that on that flight as well?
That was a 55 Strat that, yes, I bought in Chicago from Bumblebee Bob, who is a great harp player. He sold me the 55 Strat, and I think it's a 55 a Tweed Champ.
Oh, wow.
And I met him on a corner. We got off the bus. I got picked it up, gave him the money, and got back on the bus, and that was it. He was a great chap, though. We've lost him. But, yeah, and I still have that 55 Tweed Champ as well.
So That's great. So when you got it back, did you immediately bring it back on tour with you? And
as soon as it was, I left it at Gibson, because, you know, the knobs didn't work and everything was pretty much gummed up,
right.
You know. And I didn't want to change too much about it, because obviously it's really burnt. This is where the fire really got it, right.
Wow.
Here. And turned the inlay there into just a 7, you know, which is kind of neat.
Yeah.
Now. You know, you can see what it's like on the back. And I mean, I remember doing that, and there's some parts here. You can come in for a close up probably later, but there's some parts here where my guitar in the mid 70s fell off the stage and fell flat, and the knobs all went in, you know, and that was fixed. So that was another telltale thing that I knew this was mine, you know. But I just, after they made it playable, then I, in fact, the very first time we played New York, not the Academy of Music, the Beacon, I'm going back too far now. The Beacon, I believe in 2012, something like that, 11 or 12, when we did the FCA 35 second part of the tour, I brought it out for Do You Feel? And I came out after it. It was on the stage first, and we put a spotlight on it and lit it up. So, yeah, but I was doing a thing for Sunday Morning. At that time, they were doing a story on the guitar. And so Anthony asked me before I went on, he said, so how do you feel? Are you nervous? I said, yeah, I'm more nervous about playing this guitar than any other. And when I actually started let me put it on that. When I started this, I went, oh, because I was so nervous about it. So, and luckily, very nice of them, they edited that part out on Sunday Morning. But I was more nervous about playing this than playing the show, you know,
yeah.
Because, you know, it just, I don't know, it's such, made into such a big deal.
Right.
You know, especially a guitar that you had written off 32 years ago,
yeah.
You know, so it was just very, very intense moment in my career.
Yeah. Well, now that you've settled in, is it still your best sounding guitar?
I would say that it's the best sounding guitar for all the stuff that it was recorded, that it was used on.
Right, right.
You know, because it depends on if you write, say if you wrote a riff on a specific electric through a specific amp for me, there's a reason why I wrote that riff, because of the sound that I'm getting with this specific guitar and that specific amp,
right.
And whatever else I've got going on effects-wise. And that's what is inspiring me at that moment. So it's like, sound is so important to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's if I've got a bad sound, it's very hard for me to play if it's not the sound that I want. So that's why it's taken me years and years and years to sort of work out what I like and what I don't like, and you know, put it in this behemoth over here.
So how many songs are you playing this on the set as it is?
Probably about three or four.
Does the crowd go crazy every time they see it?
Well, yeah, sometimes I start off with another one and then I go, no. And then I go back and I get this one and they go, yes. So, yeah.
That's great. So what would you say is your number two on the road? Should we get into that one now?
Yeah, I mean, I have a 1960 Les Paul that I managed to pick up that was actually J.J. Cale's guitar, and he played it on the J.J. Cale 5.
Oh, wow. And
Audie, his producer, I guess he's bought it from him, and Audie passed away, and his wife wanted it to have a good home, and I heard through the grapevine that it was going up for sale. So should we bring her on?
Let's bring her on.
The guitar.
Now that's amazing when a 1960 Burst is the second best guitar.
Well, it's pretty beautiful. I mean, got that bite to it,
right?
That one doesn't. The Phoenix that I call it doesn't have. Let's do something here. It's okay if I just play a little bit, right? Let's do this. Hold on.
That is awesome. Is that guitar entirely stock?
Yes, the pickups. I'm not sure about the tuning pegs. They might.
Yeah, they may have disintegrated.
I think Aiden might have. I'm not sure. Did you?
We did have to change them, and the ones that were on there weren't stock to begin with.
They weren't, right?
Well, that's in 65 years, things will happen.
Yeah, but everything else is the same, yes.
I wonder if he wrote, like, cocaine on that.
I don't know, but if you go to J.J. Cale 5, and there's an article there's a piece on the internet on him recording it, and I think he used it on at least half, if not more, of the solos on the five. So it's got that wonderful, you know.
Were you two friends? Did you know?
I met him.
Yeah.
In the 70s, and I sat in with him once at the Whiskey a Go Go, or one of those places, and it was a highlight of my life. I'm just a huge, huge fan of his.
Honestly. Yeah. Amazing.
Wonderful.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Well, that's going to be, okay, we will, there cannot be any cooler guitars than those two, but let's see what else you're playing.
Okay, let's see. Okay, so this one, in 2010, we had a 100-year flood here in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And there's a place where most everybody, I'd say 80% of all the musicians in town and a lot of the bands around the country, for some reason, I don't know why they would store them in Nashville, but they did. And unfortunately, it was right next to a river, and the river rose above flood. And so we had a really, and people lost their houses and everything. But this place where everything was stored was underwater, and to see the damage they went in on jet skis and just looked down at the gear, all that was all flooded. So I had a guitar that was made by Gibson, and Tom Murphy had aged it for me. And that one split, you know, it was horrible stories. Sure. And unbeknownst to me, Rick Gimbaugh had gone to Tom again after the flood, and they just said, look, surprise.
Oh, that's great.
So it was, it's a beautiful, beautiful guitar, and it's a 60 reissue. Because I like the 60 neck as opposed to the 59 baseball bat.
Sure.
Because I have smaller hands, so.
You know, it's incredible. You have some of the best luck with guitars and the worst luck with guitars.
that will happen. But I mean, you know, I mean, Chicago, John Fogerty. I mean, it goes far afield as to the people that lost stuff.
Sure.
So, it was... that was a horrible time.
This is your replacement for the Tom Murphy, and you're touring with this one as well, switching off.
Yeah, this one has really got more of the, let's go back here. So this would be. You know, so that's got that.
That is a massive, massive sound, man.
Yes, was that too much for you there?
So does it have the same kind of bite as your 1960s? Same?
They're different. The 60 has, these are Tom Holmes pickups in here, and they are used on my, the reissue of the 35 reissues of the clones of the Phoenix that Gibson have put out there. And whereas the pickups on the 60 are patent applied for us.
Yeah, there's original PAs.
There's original. Wow. So it's a little calmer. This has definitely got more bite to it. But Tom's pickups are really based on patent applied for us anyway. And like he said, just because you got a patent applied for doesn't mean to say it sounds the same as the patent applied for they made yesterday. You know, they were all different.
Yeah, all different. Know. And time makes things, you know, changes things up.
Yeah,
as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, it's so great that you actually tour with these incredible museum piece guitars.
Yeah, call me crazy. But, no, it's, I can't play with something that looks good and doesn't sound good. It's got to sound good first.
Yeah.
Know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've got to see what's next in
right.
the arsenal.
Let me go to the vault. And this one is the complete opposite because it's a 64. Again, I had a 1964 335 that went through the flood, and luckily I was covered on insurance for that. A lot of people weren't, and I sort of feel guilty in a way, but because a lot of people couldn't replace everything, but I was able to replace this. So, and it is a 64 335, and it would be, let's go here. And this would be. So. There you go.
That's great, man. Great. And where'd you hone your jazz chops in? Was that your studio work?
I'm still honing those. I think I'm a jazz influence player. I wouldn't say I'm a jazz player, but I do. When I was growing up, the first two guitarists that I loved instantly. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, was Hank Marvin from the group The Shadows.
Sure.
And gosh, I don't have the Strat with me. Do we have the Strat here?
No, we do not.
No, okay. So The Shadows came out in, I don't know, 58, 59, something like that, with Cliff Richard was their singer. And he's like the British Elvis, you know. And he's still going strong. And,
really?
Yeah. And so The Shadows, Hank Marvin had a red Strat, 58 Strat. And it was just a killer sound through a Vox, you know. And with a Swiss Echo or whatever echo, tape echo thing he had at the time. And so that was my first love, was that sound. And then my parents, at the same time as I'm listening to the Shadows album, my parents are listening to what they loved, which was Django Reinhardt, Stephan Grappelli, Hot Club de France.
Right.
Which I wasn't too thrilled with at the time. It sounded like, as my kids call it, Dad's listening to that silent movie music again. but it's, once you, I remember trying to, I'd take my album off and my dad would put his Django album on and I'd see how far I could get up the stairs before I had to hear it, you know, and this jazz stuff. And and then each time he'd put it on, I wouldn't rush out of the room so quickly. And in the end, I put that one on myself because
right.
I go, this guy's incredible.
Incredible.
And it's arguably, as Sean Penn says in that movie, I'm the best except for one guy. There's one guy that's better than me. And it's Django, you know.
Yeah.
And he truly, I believe, was a genius.
Yeah,
you know?
Clearly.
And not only did he learn how to play guitar once, with all 10 fingers. He had to learn to play guitar with only 2 fingers workable on his left hand, you know, and due to a fire. And so it's just quite incredible. I listen to him every day. I mean, at least a couple of tracks a day because it's just, I don't know, it's his gypsy soul or something.
Right,
you know,
right.
That the man could play a million notes in half a second or he could play one note that would go through 5-6 different chord changes, but it was the right note.
Right.
You know, and so he wasn't always a shred in there. he was very emotional player, incredibly
yeah.
emotional player.
Yeah, amazing player. Well, that's cool. So it's because you're the British rock guys to me. So many of them had this kind of American blues influence, but your thing was just different, man. And I guess maybe that's it. Maybe it's the Django influence. It's just, to me, it always had a very jazz complexity to it, I guess.
Well, I think when everybody started in England listening to John Mayall's Blues Breakers, the
right.
Beano album, and everyone started, had the sideburns and the sneakers and was reading Beano and playing, trying to play Les Paul because of Eric, you know, I realized at that point his style was so seductive, the blues in general, but he kind of put it in a different, you saw it from a different angle. Now we've got like a 60 Les Paul through a 50 watt Marshall blasting out, you know,
right.
combo on that album, and it just was sounded great. So I said, as much as I want to go this way, I'm going to try and go another way because everyone's going this way,
right.
you know. So that's when I started to not listen to. It was hard not listening to Cream, so I did listen to Cream. But I started listening to Wes Montgomery, the early young George Benson when he was 16, with Jack McDuff,
who is incredible,
unbelievable.
Yeah,
and Grant Green, Kenny Burrell, Django. So many of the players, the jazz players, Joe Pass, who I have to slow him way down.
Oh, incredible!
to learn
yeah,
him.
yeah. The stuff you did with Ella Fitzgerald, just the two of them, it sounds like it's incredible.
Yeah, he was another genius, definitely.
Yeah.
But I have so much respect for so many different styles of guitar playing. You know, from Tom Morello to Wes Montgomery is a big leap, you know.
Right, right.
And I got to meet Tom not so long ago. Great guy. And I'm a huge fan of what he kind of reinvented with effects and his playing, his style. And he's done a lot for guitar. He's an amazing player. So, but then, you know, I go back and listen to Tequila by Wes Montgomery, which is unbelievable. Just fantastic stuff.
You know? Yeah, that's great. That's great, man.
Hank Garland is another one.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many. And then, of course, you know, I'm interspersing that with all the Kings. You know, BB,
Albert,
yeah,
Freddie.
You know, between all the Kings, you've got just about all the blues there as far as lead guitar.
Yeah.
Hubert Sumlin, you know, Muddy, obviously. Just, and then Little Walter playing harp. I wish I could play guitar as well as he plays harp. You know, he's just got this, again, very inspiring, you know, distorted. He wanted to sound like a guitar, I think, you know. So, been inspired by all that and more, and classical and whatever.
Yeah, and it's great that you change your tones. You go to different guitars, get different tones that kind of take you into different, mm-hmm. you know, different directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when doing the Fingerprints instrumental record, that was like doing an album for each track was like doing an album, because I had to go to England to do the one with Hank and the Shadows, going to New York, going to LA, you know, so it was a project that took quite a long time, because just about every track had a guest with me. Warren Haynes on there, I love Warren, and lovely guy, as great player. And so yeah, it was a very exhausting labor of love doing that, and I thought I'd never get to do an instrumental album, but I just said, it's time, I gotta do it.
That's great.
Had a lot of people come and help.
That's great.
There it is. That's the, yeah, and this one is the Dick Boak from Martin. I met up with him at a NAMM show many years ago. And I told him the story about how I had, when I left Humble Pie, I went straight to Manny's in, that puts us back, in 48th Street in New York. And I ordered D45 Martin. And because I wanted to sound like Stephen Stills.
Sure. And who wouldn't?
Yeah. That one.
Yeah.
And which it does sound like. And so I put all the money I had left down on this guitar. Okay. And it was 1971. And so I got it, and I wrote Lines on My Face on that guitar. Most of Frampton's Camel was written on that guitar. And Then we went out on tour to promote the album, and between the Agora Cleveland and the Agora somewhere else, it left me. Somebody else walked away with it.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So another terrible story.
Yeah, sure.
Another really awful story for you. And so I went off Martin's. It's like, I don't know if you ever had your car stolen.
No.
And got it back. It's one thing when they steal it. It's another thing when you get it back and you go, ooh, I don't want to get in it now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, but I never got the guitar back, so yeah. I never wanted. So anyway, I'm speaking with Dick Boak from Martin and dear friend, and I told him the story, and he said, well, we're going to have to do you a guitar. He said, how about a D42, though? I said, fine, which means it just has, or the 45 has this on the back as well, the inlay around here, and the 42 doesn't. I said, this is perfect. And so we chose the wood and an Adirondack top and everything. And he said, I've got this idea for having a camel on it, because it's a Frampton's camel. So you can probably see there if you want to do a close-up. But and it's on the inside in the label there. It's the Frampton's camel D42.
Oh, that's great. So you've always had acoustic elements to your live set.
Yes.
What were you playing? What did you play in Frampton Comes Alive?
That was my, which I still have, that lived through the flood, barely. That's my 1964 Texan.
Oh, wow.
Which I bought the first time we recorded or rehearsed with Humble Pie. I needed an acoustic and had the road manager go out and pick me up one like Steve's. I want an Epiphone, you know. And we got all the Epiphones in England. The Gibson stayed here, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's why Paul McCartney, Blackbird. Right?
That's where we were playing Hofner's for a while, too.
Oh.
It's what we could get our hands on, you know. And so he came back with this Texan. I went, wow, that's great. And Steve had a Frontier Epiphone. And so we had matching Epiphones and matching Gretsch guitars.
Oh, you know? Great.
So, and that guitar's been with me forever.
Now, what pickup are you using with this live?
This one is a Bags pickup. Nearly all my guitars have 99.9% have the Bags pickups in. I think there's one Gibson that came with a pickup in, which is also a Bags, actually. So it's 100% Bags. But I use different different types, models in different guitars. For instance, the Epiphone has a dual source pickup in it, which is a microphone and the bridge. Mm-hmm. Whereas this one has the I-beam in it, I believe. So it's not the microphone, but it's the I-beam and the under the bridge pickup. Mm-hmm. Bo from Bags has been unbelievable in working with me, and he just emailed me the other day. He wants to send me another one to have me send him a guitar to put something in. He's used me as a test bed, you know, which is wonderful. And I've got comments on the Anthem one that they call. So we're working on improving that, you know, it's great.
Great. And you run that into an Avalon Pre and then?
Yes, just recently from the acoustic tour on, we started using the Avalons, and it just makes a huge difference.
Oh, that's great.
It really does.
Killer guitar. Well, all the guitars are killer. I mean,
thank you.
I think now we should address that huge beast.
The behemoth? Yeah.
Over there.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we are in the amp land. Now, back in Humble Pie, you literally had a guitar, cable, and an amp.
100 watt Marshall into a slanted cabinet. By the time we did Rockin' the Fillmore, I had a 50 watt into a slanted cabinet too. So I had 150 watts.
Uh-huh.
But it was straight from, in the end, the Phoenix.
Yeah.
Straight into one amp and then linked from the bottom into the next amp.
And no effects?
No effects.
Wow.
No effects.
And now?
all the effects I could ever get into one, you know. But I do have a very small car. All right. This is it, you know.
And this lives on stage, I mean, yeah, on stage within left. Access.
Yeah, I have access to it. Aiden Mullen, my wonderful tech, has one controller. He control it from right behind you here. He's got a duplicate control pedal that I do there. And this is made by Access, who are now owned by Boogie. Either one of us, if I'm over the other side of the stage, obviously he can change.
Sure.
And he does, yeah. You know, change stuff for me.
And so what is the basic, what are we running here?
Well, a lot of it is backup. So you've got, I'm using this as a backup at the moment. This was a early 70s Marshall that I had, Jose Arredondo, who did all of Eddie's amps. Mm. He worked on this for me and gave me a loop out the back, and so I could drive effects with it. And this was one that John Sir, who's a dear friend of mine, and has made guitars for me, and he cloned this twice. So I have two of these, which used to serve as power amps for the outside cabinets. So basically, if you think of it like this is the center cabinet of the Marshall, there's three cabinets.
Which is your dry
signal. Dry, this is just dry. Then the loop comes out of there and feeds the effects over here. And front end are over here, and then the stereo effects are over here. And the stereo effects come back through a little mixer here, little main mixer, and go through this Boogie 100 watt, what's it called? 2100, yeah, power amp here, which drive the outside two Marshall cabinets. Okay. And then there's another output which sends effects and dry, which has got another mixer, to the two Leslies that are there. So in the early days, when I first put together a mono rig with effects with my, after I left Humble Pie, I would have the effects I would have for Frampton Comes Alive was the Phoenix again, that would go into the system, and it would go through a MXR90, which I have an old one like it now.
Yeah.
Like one of the, that was the first real effect, apart from a wah-wah, really, and Roger Mayer's early effects for Hendrix. And then out of that, it went into a Binson Ecorec 2, which is the same disc delay machine as Dave Gilmour used to use with Pink Floyd. They were Italian made. And then out of that, it would go into my Marshall, but it would also get split into, I would rent a Leslie cabinet everywhere I went.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I would have one Leslie, yeah, and then just the one cabinet, basically.
And always spinning.
Always on, yeah. There was no way in those days to turn it off. It was like on or that's it, you know. So those were the only effects I had. And then I decided that I wanted to go stereo along the way. So that's when I started working with Bob Bradshaw. Mm-hmm. And he had the first real going through the front end of the amp for the front end effects, and then the loop driving the stereo effects.
Sure.
That was the first time I'd done that. And then along the way, things just started, like when I did the Bowie's Glass Spider tour, he made me a completely new setup for that, the Glass Spider rig, I call it, and that was 87. And that's when I was using a John Sir Maple Strat loaded with two humbuckers and a Strat pickup in the middle. And then I started working with Mark Snyder, my tech, who's now runs a lot of wine. He's a wine distributor now, and just does this kind of stuff for kicks now. So he's doing really well. And he was my tech for a long time, and he started building my racks.
Oh.
And this one here is his latest incarnation, and he, you know, he's phenomenal at putting it all together, and oh. So is Bob Bradshaw. You know, it's just that Mark was with me at the time, so he sort of took over, and that's when we went to the Access Electronics pedal programmer, and it's built slowly but surely into this.
Wow. And the basement, where does that come into play?
The basement is a preamp. I can select the Marshall front end, mm-hmm. going into the rear, the power section of this. Or I can not choose the front end of that. I can choose the front end of this and go into the back end of this, so it's still dry. So I can choose, even though it's one amp, I can choose what preamp I use to go into the, so they all have the same characteristic.
Right. Wow, that's really clever. That's a great way
to
do it.
So and also then I can choose the Egnator, which I really only use one of its preamps here, another clean one. And together, the basement and the Egnator, one has the warmer side and the Egnator has a little brighter side. So I put them on together, and that's when I was...
like a 335?
Right, exactly.
Oh, God, that was great.
Yes. And then at the push of a button, I can go back to the solo, and then I'm using the front end of this going into its own rear end. Can we say that? and you know, that's so. If you turned everything else off and just, you know, plug straight into this Marshall with the cable into that cabinet, it would be the same as I was using with Humble Pie.
Yeah.
So you know, but then, once you take, so from the loop in the back, that's where everything changes. So that's when it all gets sent into all these effects over
right.
here.
And you're hardwired in, just a cabled quarter inch.
Yeah, I have yet to find a wireless that, I went wireless for a while. I had to for the Bowie tour,
sure.
Glass Spider, because there were so many dancers and you had to get out of the way. It was all choreographed for us too, you know. And, because they would change my settings and they'd dance on my pedal, you know. So I'd be in the middle of a really loud solo and they'd turn me off, or I'd be in the middle of a really quiet lead part and they'd turn me full blast. So no more dances for me. Yes. So yeah, I forget where we're going here.
Hardwires. Yeah,
hardwire. That's right. Yeah, that's. I went to dances from hardwires. I'm not sure how, but. No, so very, very hard. Once I picked up a Les Paul again in the 90s, I came to live here in Nashville for the first time. It's my second time living here. And so I went to Gibson and they gave me the big tour. And at the beginning I saw a Honeyburst body, just the body. And I said, oh, that's beautiful. By the time I finished, they gave it to me finished. So it was, and it wasn't light, but it just reintroduced me to Les Pauls again. And once I plugged that in, I felt at home again, you know.
Right.
Just had that extra girth,
right.
Should we say.
Right.
And just my, but it can also be so sweet sounding, you know. You know, you got it all in there. So that's when I started going back to the cable.
Right.
And I've tried, but so far I haven't found what I need.
Well, you were always manipulating your sound with your controls, your tone and your volume. And I do think things subtleties like that are lost with a wireless.
Well, I don't want to put down Wireless because a lot of people just love them, right, and they work great for them. Yeah. For me, I liked, if someone can give me a wireless that I can just, okay, plug in straight like normal with a cable, and then plug me into the wireless and plug it straight in, and I don't have to change anything, and it sounds the same as the cable, yeah. I'll change.
Yeah, after there's going to be companies that send you like tons of them. After this, they say, oh, we got the one, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is amps. Let's talk about your pedal drawer and what's in this pile of goodies.
Okay, well, these are more of the front end effects. I've got the Klon Centaur, which I've had for years and love it. It's just the one for me. It just works for
sure.
Me. And but also I love the full tone OCD, which is always in here too. One is they're both perfect for different things, mm-hmm. you know. So and so I love both of them. This is the Creation Audio Labs boost pedal, and I use that just for a slight lift. If I'm just using the Marshall, which I don't set on clean, I set on sort of crunch sound. This will take me to in between a rhythm sound and a lead sound, like a quieter lead sound.
Sure.
So it just gives me a step up there. And okay, so this is still front end.
Front.
This I've got a Fox Tone, which I've had for years. This is a newer one, but I just FOXX, and I love that just for that one Hendrix-y, the octave that goes sky high. You
right,
know,
right.
It's beautiful. It's a very thin sound, but it's a beautiful, especially with a delay on it or something like that. And then it gets used maybe for 15 seconds a night, you know what I mean? But
yeah.
It's there, you
it's
know.
It's a glorious 15 seconds.
It is. Thank you. No, and then this is the POG, which is the polyphonic octave generator, it says here. But you can actually, it was the first thing that you could actually play chords with and it would track.
Right.
And play it an octave down, an octave up, an octave two octaves up.
Yeah, no latency, great octave.
It's really good and very effective. So it makes the guitar sound like an organ almost. And so that's that. That gets used for the other 15 seconds. And then these, here's the MXR. I did buy an old, as you can see, very used original MXR, kind of like the one I would have probably had for Frampton's Camel.
Sure.
I mean, Frampton Comes Alive.
Yeah, the script, that's great.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then these two are the Mutron effects, which I just by chance picked up this one, and I had also had an octave pedal as well of theirs. But this one has got that auto-wah sound.
Right.
But it's, I'll show you that. I use that... it gets heavily featured on Black Hole Sun, which is on the Fingerprints record. And it's just got this really nice auto-wah kind of, it'll open up depending on how you play the note, you know. Mm. So it's really interesting. And this is another one. So I have one set on going the low octave and one on the high octave. They're different era pedals, but they both work for what they're selected for. And then I think we have, this is more of the, there's more front end effects down there. We can get to them in a minute, but this basically, that's front end, the Cali 76. This is like for those who know studio gear, it's an 1176 limiter. Well, this is an 1176 limiter in a pedal, basically, and it really is. Mm. It's very, very expressive, and it's even got the same kind of knobs on the real 1176. That's like the standard limiter we use in the studio.
Yeah, those are very subtle. That's a great pedal.
Yeah, it really is, and they also make one that's two in one, That's for slide, for the Lowell George continuous note for days, which it also works really well for as well.
Yeah, the slide rig.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's over there. I've got that. And then this is an after effect. Obviously, it's a mono effect, but it's being sent from the loop, whereas these are all front-end effects. They came out with this pedal recently, and really enjoyed the original Korg pedal. Korg, what was it?
Yeah, it was a rack mount.
What was it called, though?
SDD 3000, of course, yeah.
So the original Korg effect was an SDD 3000, which I think I have one way back, and they finally, I think with the Edge wanted one in a pedal, so because he loved that original sound, because it had, with its preamp and everything in it, it definitely has a warm sound that comes with this this piece. I got one and just loved it. So I kind of treat it like my Benson Echo, because if you set it on its own modeling of the SDE-3000, it's very, very warm sounding delay. And I wanted one that decayed and sort of got a little duller rather than staying bright, you know? And this does that. And as well as many other things, obviously now it's MIDI controlled, so it's fantastic for my system. And I can store as many delays as I want for different presets over there.
And you control the tap from over there?
No, I don't have a tap. I pre-do mine.
Oh.
So it's, I guess we play the numbers at the same speed every night. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't have it. This does have a tap, but it's over here.
Yeah.
If I wanted to, I could come over here if we were jamming and something happened. I can come over here and tap it.
Sure.
But I don't have one over there. I got enough going on over
there. Yeah. Well, and you're set for every song, so
yes.
Yeah. See, the BPMs are the same. Yeah. That's the way to do it.
Okay. And so we've been through this lot. Oh, yeah. No, we've got one more tray here. This is an old Boss Chorus, the original one.
Oh, wow.
And it's on its last legs, but it still sounds good.
That chorus sounds amazing.
Yeah, and that I use for another, I think, 20 seconds. I use it on the Ebo intro to Black Hole Sun.
Oh.
And then that, it just makes it a little mysterious sounding. So everything's for a reason, you know. It's not, okay, well, let's slap this on here. That's not me. I really work hard on getting specific effects for different things. And love this thing. But, okay, do you want to move over here?
Yeah, let's see what's on the floor. So here's what you have on the floor in front of you?
Yes. Well, we're finishing off the front end effects, and I believe I played a little bit of the using the chopper. This one here is these two are Gig Effects pedals, which are very special actually, and they're very well made and sound great. This one has I use it for this sort of in time chop sound, like that. And then this is actually a Peter Frampton Gig Effects pedal,
nice.
Which is basically an auto wah, and it works in conjunction. I use it in conjunction with the chop, and it gives this kind of gallopy feel. So I think you can hear that. We did a little bit of that earlier.
Right. Yeah, great tone. So, and they're controlled almost like a wah where you depress and...
Well, they're basically preset.
Okay.
And when you do that, they're on.
Oh,
I mean, there is a way, I have them set that way, but there is a way where you can have them set so that the further you push this down, the faster the chop gets.
Sure.
But I have it set for specific songs, obviously, at different speeds. And then Yeah, this is the Dunlop. I'm sorry. It's the custom. It's the Bob Bradshaw wah, but I'm. Doesn't that come from?
Yeah, it's Dunlop.
It is Dunlop.
Yeah,
right?
there. It's a. I think it's a kind
Bradshaw
of a consortium.
Did it with them, right?
Yeah. It's phenomenal. It's the meatiest wah there is. Lot of meat, and then I use an oldie worldie whammy. One of the, I believe, the second incarnation. Mm. For the octave above or the octave below.
Right.
And I'll use that, not quite like Tom Morello, but but along the same lines. I use it a little differently. And so that's what's down here.
Yeah. And the MXR microamp as well?
Yeah, when we coupled these into the system, I found that a couple of the pedals, it wasn't unity gain. So when we took this out of the system, I was at this level, and when we plugged it in, it just went down like this, and a little bit, and I didn't like that. So we got the MXR microamp in there to just bring it up so that it's, even with these pedals off, mm-hmm. it's unity gain. You know
okay.
what I mean? So that it's all set.
Does that always remain on?
Yes, it does, to keep those in line mm. with these guys. Those guys.
Perfect. Hey, while we're here.
Yes.
So that's an iconic piece right there.
The Framtone Talkbox, yes. Obviously, I started using the Bob Heil Talkbox. And when I first heard about it, I was doing All Things Must Pass album with George Harrison at Abbey Road. And that's when, from Nashville, Pete Drake, the incredible, iconic pedal steel player, came over to Abbey Road and played on the more country, like If Not For You, uh-huh. Behind That Locked Door, and those. And I played acoustic on all those. Tracks with Pete and George, and Badfinger were also playing acoustic as well, because it was Phil Spector was the producer, and he wanted more is better.
What a session!
Yeah. and so in a slow moment, you know, Pete got out this little box, put it on the thing, and got a pipe and plugged it in, and all of a sudden. He got this pipe in his mouth, and the pedal steel started talking to me and singing to me, you know. And I was just floored, you know, because I'd heard that kind of sound on radio. They would do their call letters with 94.16, you know, all that,
right.
with that kind of sound. I forget what that gadget's called.
Yeah.
But this was it live. You know, I was seeing this thing. I said, where do I get one of those? So, well, I made this one. So that one that I saw him use, Joe Walsh, and I've corroborated this with Joe, Pete Drake lent it to Joe to do Rocky Mountain Way. And that's what he used on the record.
Wow.
That exact one.
Wow.
And then Bob Heil obviously was involved, was a dear friend of Joe's and mine, but has known Joan much longer than me. And he said, well, let's make a bigger one that's a little louder, because it was very quiet. And so that's where the Heil Talkbox came
wow.
from, was from that, from Pete Drake lending it to Joe Walsh.
Amazing. And that is, and you're driving your 100-watt Marshall with this?
Yes.
You could lose a filling, right?
Well, it's not as loud as you'd think, but I always did use, even with the original Heil ones, I always did use a 100-watt with it, because it was plugged into the system,
mm-hmm.
whereas this one has a designated amp to drive
sure.
it. Before, you used to, it would go in into the, out of the speaker jack, into there, out of there, back into the other speaker jack, you
right.
know, into the amp, into the speaker. And so you would be reliant on whatever level you were set for your guitar would be for the talk
right.
box.
So
well.
If you're on Stun, it's
Stun.
Yeah.
It's fillings coming out your mouth. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, And so again, Mark Snyder and John Regan actually put together a company called Framtone, put an E on the end of my name, and we are coming back, I think, and doing some more of them because we're getting asked for more of my little amp switches and the talk box. And so that brings us to more switching over here, which is sort of the mission control over here on the Access Audio switching pedals here. Yes, this is mission control here, and the whole thing was the concept of Mario Marino. He's from Toronto, and he came up with Access Electronics. And this is not a new piece at all. It's got some age to it, but it just is so great for me. I just love this. I know it inside out, how to program it. I program it from my laptop, on the bus, after a gig. If I want to change, I didn't like that, I want to change something. So I'll change it on my laptop, email it to Aiden, and when he gets to line check in, setting the stuff up, he just loads the new program in there. And so I can change the set list whenever I want, you know. And so this basically is, it does so much, but I'll try and make it simple. Basically, you can see there's all the different effects, like you've got Egnator, preamp, Marshall, Bassman, and then you can see there's the 1210, which is the chorus, the Eclipse, which is the harmonizer, the Leslie, which is up there, Cali 76, the limiter, the speed of the Leslie, and then I've got three delays, one, two, and three. The Klon is over here, and then you've got all these others here, the Mutron, Pog, and another compressor, MXR, that boost pedal we went through, Mutron 1, Mutron 2, Fox, and that's another amp, Deluxe, which was modified by Alexander Dumble for me, it's a cleaner sound, which we use when we're doing more of the instrumental stuff. And then Hank is actually a Hank Marvin type of effect, with delays that I use for specific things. But so if we see 01 in the green screen there, that means that something's happening. And for the intro, I've chosen the Marshall, the Leslie. That's the basic setup. Mm. And then if I go to 2, that puts the Leslie speed on for me, so which I... On the live album, you'll hear me make it go fast or slow. So that's that. And then, what we've got here, not sure what that's for there. but this is the solo here. And then, which I've got the Marshall 1210 Eclipse, the Leslie stays on, the Klon and delay 3, which is that Korg delay.
Wow.
And then if I come to preset 6 is nearly always my solo, and then here it'll be the solo with speed, with the Leslies on fast. And you can hear them going now. And so I have 6 presets for each song.
Wow, that's
you can tell these two I don't think I'm using at all. But there's something in there. And then here, I'll take it to Dubois, which is the second number. And that's a completely different sound. It's the two clean amps, 1210, but it's still using the MXR90, because that's all I had on Comes Alive. And again, there's the Leslie speed. Here's the bridge part. You know, I mean, I can go into as much detail as you want, but the bridge is basically a lot of different delays going on. And so again, it's a completely different sound.
That's great though, to be able to, with just a touch of a button, get a radically different sound in the same song for like a bridge or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then that will be the solo, and there's a solo with the Leslie on. So, and we go on and on and on throughout the whole set like
Wow.
that.
Great way to reproduce live what you're doing in the studio and get it just dead on.
Well, that was the whole idea of getting a guitar system together, a stereo guitar rig together for me, was that I was using more effects in the studio on certain songs, and I wouldn't have them available to me for live. And so that's why, bit by bit, I've added an effect here, an effect there. Like I said, some of them only last in the whole act a few seconds,
right.
You know. But that's special for those few seconds. And it's not something that I use all the time.
Right. Yeah, there's a reason you put it there in the first place. So, right. You know, why not reproduce it? Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So, but it just about covers everything, you know. I mean, this isn't to say that if I'm sitting playing my Les Paul straight plugged into an old Fender Deluxe, that's a beautiful sound, you know, but that's all it does.
Yeah.
I've got nothing to add to that for live.
Right, know? Right.
Whereas Neil Young still has his deluxes with this automator thing that it's like a dinosaur age, but it works for him.
Yeah.
It'll turn, he'll have presets and it'll turn the level up, the tone down or whatever. And when I saw that, I thought that's something that I would have done back then. You know? But he still got it, you know,
yeah.
He still uses it. And I think it's because it works.
Right.
You know, for him, and he's got effects that he can use. His rig, he's worked to be able to use his effects with those old deluxes, and it's still got that signature deluxe sound. You know?
Right, right. Wow.
And I'm doing that with the Marshall. Basically, if you turn all this off and leave the Marshall on, it's a guitar into a Marshall.
Is there a emergency switch that gives you that? If anything, just if it all goes to hell, you can...
First of all, if my main amp goes down, there is a group of switches that you just throw all at once, and it'll send everything. It'll change the speaker, the loop, the signal, everything. It changes in a split second to the amp below. And that's set to match as close as that. So you wouldn't notice the difference. But if I look at Aiden, I go, it's gone, you know, it's time for the big switch, you know. So that's that. And if something goes wrong with any front end effect, that will cut me out. There's a switch that you can just turn that rack off.
Oh.
And turn the front end rack off. And I believe, I'm not sure if there's a switch to turn the back end effects off. I don't think so. It's just, if you disconnect... If it's in the front end and you turn that off and all the sound comes back, you know it's
right.
In that rack.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I don't have a switch that if everything went that I could, it would be going back to the Deluxe. You know, I'd have to drag the Deluxe out. But
it's as simple as pulling two cables out of the back and he's on the Marshall without anything. Everything's out of it.
Right. So we've pretty much covered, I've been in awful situations and lived through situations where nothing worked.
Right.
It just went down and stayed down. And I'm not gonna say anymore. But we have fail safes now that I've never had before. So, and Mark Snyder was the one that came up with that, which is phenomenal.
Wow, that's great. Well, Peter, this is really inspiring, man. Thank you so much for, letting us see behind the curtains.
it's much too much stuff, but, it looks a lot more than it actually is. It's just because it's all analog and it's, everything's, there's two of everything because there's a backup.
Right.
I'm embarrassed to say it's too big. But the sound is phenomenal.
Yeah, the sound, yeah, totally worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, to stand in front of this rig and hear it, totally worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is John Bollinger with Premier Guitar. Until next time.
Don't forget to sign up for PG Perks, your all-access pass to exclusive gear giveaways and discounts on PremierGuitar.com.